Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders in sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness and highlight best practices in order to help more people, institutions, and companies transition more capital into the industry faster. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time to listen to our guests, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. I am JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners, and we are the proud sponsors of the podcast. ILM Partners is an advisory and soon-to-launch multi-asset management firm targeting to acquire and scale investment funds focused on sustainability and impact, one of the fastest-growing areas of investment management globally, enabling investors to generate returns with confidence whilst having a net positive impact in the world. Our mission is to facilitate and accelerate the transition of £5 billion of capital to sustainable and impact investing in the next 5 years. If you would like to explore the opportunity of working together, email contact@ilaandpartners.com using podcast intro as reference in the subject line for an introductory and confidential conversation. Your support means everything to us, since it's what really keeps us going. So make sure you share our work with someone that will benefit from it. Please remember to subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred platform and follow us on social media to stay connected by selecting your favorite application using the links in the notes of each episode. We hope you enjoy today's special conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is healthy and safe and that you're finding the inspiration and actions to make the most of this new world that we're living in. Today's episode of Impact Leaders is the second on our new series called The Sustainable Investment Dilemma, looking into how industries can help address the climate and social crisis, in particular, the financial industry, taking on the opportunity to address the way it has funded the activities that have put us in our current situation. I invite you all to visit our sponsor's website and the YouTube channel to watch the first video interview on this important subject as part of the launch of this series. And to begin with our guest today, we have Daniela Barone Soares. Hello and welcome, Daniela.
Thank you, and well done for the right pronunciation of my name. Perfect.
Very nice. Thank you very much for being with us today. As you will learn very soon, Daniela is originally from Brazil, and hence the pronunciations always become a challenge, the same as with my name. But yes, I made sure, by the way, I practiced before so that I don't take all the credit. And Daniela, you are today actually in Brazil.
I am. I am based in the UK. I'm based in London. But I came here at the end of the year to see my family. And with this pandemic, I wasn't able to come before. And then I ended up staying because everybody's working remotely and my flights were canceled. So I decided to stay a little longer, actually much longer in the end.
Very nice. And so it is our first time that we are recording live with somebody from South America, which is, I like the first, a lot of firsts in the podcast. You were mentioning before as well, I think you were in a place called Guarajá, which is near São Paulo.
That's right. So I'm on the coast. I'm actually working and looking at a beautiful beach right in front of me. So yeah. Maybe your listeners actually don't want to hear that at this stage if they are in the UK.
Yes, but I think it's nice for context and also to ignite people's imagination. We have listeners actually from all over the world. I think a large portion is from the UK and Europe, but we have people listening from the US and South America all the way to APAC, including Australia. So yes,
fantastic.
It's just... I think it's nice, you know, that people can just imagine. So I always ask that question. So as an introduction, let me share with the audience kind of a short version of your bio, again, for context and the benefit if they haven't met you before. So Daniela is the CEO of Snowball, a multi-asset impact investment firm based in the UK, and joined the company in September 2019. Excited about systemic solutions for a healthy, prosperous, and peaceful future in this planet. Daniela has over 14 years experience as CEO at the intersection of the commercial and impact worlds, starting her career in private equity and venture capital investing, and then spending 9 years at the helm of Impetus, a venture philanthropy leader. She has a track record in leading organizations through sustainable growth, innovation, and high performance. Daniela chairs a social technology business, Gove.digital, that's G-O-V-E, and .digital, and is a non-executive director at Halma PLC, that's H-A-L-M-A. She has received various accolades, including being selected the Financial Times and Inclusive Boards as one of the top 100 women in engineering in 2019, by Brazil's Isto é Dinheiro magazine as one of the 20 people who are changing Brazil and the world for the better in 2017, and by The Independent on Sunday as one of 100 people who make Britain a better place in the happy list in 2008. And she holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and Bachelor in Science in Economics from Unicamp in Brazil. So again, welcome to Impact Leaders, Daniela, and it's a real pleasure to have you. And I'm very happy to have you in the podcast today.
My pleasure. My pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice. And I must admit that since we spoke last time, in the build-up to today, I have been, you know, very excited for our listeners to learn more about you, your story, and what you're doing today and for the future. And I'm certain that they will find it truly inspirational. So let's start with, you know, our first question, which is, what is sustainable and impact investing, Daniela?
Well, the way that I look at this is that every investment has impact, you know, positive, negative, there is always an impact. So I don't think, in a way, you know, some people look at this as, oh, impact investing is a separate asset class or is a separate type of investment. Every single investment has a risk, a return, and an impact. The challenge is that most investments do not account for this third impact dimension. And because of that, as investors, we invest with one eye shut to the consequences of our investment. So the way that I will describe it, I try to separate a little bit the sustainable to the impact investing, because I think there is a difference.
Yes.
They're both good, but when you call sustainable or say ESG, they tend to look at the environmental, social, and governance issues from a risk-based approach. And often they don't look at the product or service that a company is actually producing. So at an extreme, you could have a fossil fuel company with good ESG. So that for me is sort of the ESG end of it. Sustainable is actually trying to do something about it a little bit more. But impact means that those investments are intentional in contributing to solutions for people and the planet. They also think about the concept of additionality. So is this thing that we are doing here, product, service, is it additional to what might have happened anyway, or is it something that is just happening anyway? And also the measurability of it, so that you can always track improvements and have feedback and engage stakeholders on this process. So impact is intentional, additional, and measurable, and incorporates the sort of risk-based approach of ESG and goes a step further. Another way to define, which I like a lot actually, is the ABC that the Impact Management Project uses. And I like that even better than that, than the ESG Sustainable, which is A for avoiding harm. So these are investments that, you know, they might not be contributed to solutions, but they are at least avoiding harm. And then the B is for benefiting stakeholders. So you already have a more proactive approach around engaging and benefiting stakeholders. And the third, the C, is contributing to solutions. So in the case of Snowball, all our investments are in the last two categories. They are either benefiting stakeholders or contributing to solutions.
Now that's very interesting. And that's very much aligned, you know, to the way I see it in terms of in the big umbrella I always talk about, a sustainable investing, ESG, and then impact within that. And I like, you know, asking this question always to everyone, because everyone has a slightly different definition. But I think that this one, I think the way you put it is very, very much, you know, the way I look at it. And it resonates in terms of always additionality, measurability, and then obviously engagement. And thank you for sharing the ABC. And I think I'm sure that we're going to talk a little bit more about it on the impact measurement section. So another question I had, which is in relation to the series, which is, you know, are we facing a sustainable investment dilemma? You know, we create all the problems by funding the companies. And it's interesting that you mentioned, I like that. I don't think anyone talked about it that way before, the product that the companies are producing, right?
Yeah.
So are we facing a dilemma now in terms of, you know, what we have created and what the machine is meant to do and where we have to go next? And I know that in your website, you talk about disruption and how we can disrupt the current status quo. So maybe we can link together and talk about that.
Yes, I think we are, because I think we need to take the climate and social emergency seriously. And if we want to have time to do a proper transition to clean energy, to better solutions for those very challenging issues that we face as a global society, we need to start doing this now, actually yesterday, actually yeah. last decade, right? So we do have a dilemma, because there's a massive inertia in the way that financial markets operate. Oh, we've always done that, so we continue to do that. Yes, we've always done it this way, so we continue to do it this way. And I think we need to do something very, very different. So from a perspective of funding, we can't stop funding companies all of a sudden. Especially because in poor countries, you know, you can't just have, at least not immediately, only renewable energy. You know, you have to get accessible energy for people. And a lot of it is renewable, and it's great. But that transition will take some time, and we have a responsibility to do it properly. But that's why it needs to be done now. It needs to start now. And I do think that especially the larger companies could do faster than what they are doing. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of them will only do it under pressure from investors and from the way that we invest. And that's why it's important. I think it's a very important role of the financial industry to make sure that we also don't get accommodated with the status quo and start to really put some incentives and pressure for companies to transition faster, especially the ones that have more resources to do so.
Yes. I'm going to paraphrase a famous statement, which is the best time to do sustainable and impact investment was 10 years ago, or to start.
Yeah.
And the next time to do it is today, right? So I think it's there's something around trees normally, right? So the best time to plant the tree and the next day.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with you there. And then just you do mention a couple of really good points as well. And then you talked about on the disruption part, you know, you talked about intentionality before, which is, you know, going beyond generating financial return. But you also, I think, mentioned something around kind of incentives and transparency and accessibility. Is anything that you want to share with us or those 3 points?
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about disruption. So Snowball was created to disrupt the way that financial markets operate, because at the moment, still, it's not just in financial markets, but if I take financial markets, we still look and act as if people and nature are inputs into the financial process and inputs for financial gain. Instead of thinking financial markets are to support people and planet, right? So we need to really disrupt. And I think part of it is the mindset. And then I think sort of, you know, how companies are run. So for example, our governance structure is one that enshrines the mission of Snowball. Our governance structure is one where there is, we take out the greed of financial markets in the sense of the benefits of scale goes to investors. So the larger our fund, the smaller the fee that investors will pay, because we're not meant to be doing ridiculous profits. We'll pay people well, but not excessively. We are putting together a very sustainable and connected culture. you know, with our investors, with our various stakeholders, so that this is actually part of something bigger in terms of transforming the system, as I said before, from one that exploits people and planet to one that is at the service of people and planet. And just to talk about governance a little bit more in terms of our mission, it's locked in the Articles of Association. We're also a big corp. We are shareholders, you know, are non-profit organizations, so they will not benefit from selling Snowball to the highest bidder, for example, you know. So there is a lot of protection to the mission and protection to what we intend to do. But the disruptive bit, so Snowball was created with the idea of having, with two big ambitions and sort of which are disruptive. One is to transform financial markets, and that having every investment managed for risk, return, and impact. And the second one is to give everyone the opportunity to invest in solutions to the world's greatest challenge, right? So most people want their investments to align with their values. There was a survey, I think, in end of 2019, which in the UK, which was about financing the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And they showed, they asked people, and they showed that most people will like to invest aligned with their values. And also there were other very revealing things in that survey as well. And that was UK-based, but I don't think it's just UK people that would like to invest aligned with their values. So with those two ambitions of transforming the financial market and to making it accessible to everyone, Snowball was then created to be an easy, low-risk way to invest for impact. So impact is not an add-on or a product. This is all we do. You know, our investment strategy has enough diversification to allow us to sort of maximize the impact and deliver really attractive and stable returns over the long term. So in this crisis, for example, we are still, you know, this year at almost 4%, you know, so in the total portfolio. And in a way, this strategy of fund of funds, global, highly diversified, five different asset classes, and across the UN Sustainable Development Goals, we are the only ones with this strategy in the market that have a four-year track record. And so this strategy allows us to arrive at a balanced, diversified, and low volatility in the portfolio. So that is how we are creating the track record in the future. So right now we're a limited partnership. And what we want is to then IPO this limited partnership when we have more assets under management, so that it then becomes a truly retail available proposition for everyone to invest with impact, with a fairly sort of with a low volatility portfolio. And just to give you a sense, you know, over this last 4 years, we have assessed over 300 funds and investment opportunities and selected 29 of those for our portfolio.
Let me come back to that. Yeah.
And just to give you a sense of numbers, again, to talk about the diversification, this is 416 companies and social enterprises. So it's 300 funds that we assessed. So this is kind of our pipeline. Selected 29 funds for the portfolio. And underlying those funds, there are 416 companies and social enterprises.
Interesting. Yes. Let me come back to that in a second. I was just going to say, thank you for the clarification around the governance and the structure, you know, in this case, the legal structure, and then interesting as well, the ambition, you know, to the specific IPO to, again, you know, this word that, you know, some other firms use, which is that, you know, to truly democratize the access.
That's right.
And then the fact that this is very interesting. And even, you know, knowing you and knowing about Snowball, as you go into the website, it's almost impossible to just work it all out. And that's why I love it that we have this conversation, because the fact that you mentioned that you are a big corp, I think you said shareholders are non-for-profit, you know, it is a kind of in your articles of association in terms of, you know, what happens and how you're going to develop. So it's very interesting to hear that with that behind it, that then you're going to actually IPO to continue with that mission and that vision. So it's very, very interesting. And you can see, again, the commerciality all behind it.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned also the kind of the incentives in terms of, it's a pretty straightforward kind of service fee that you charge. and you have this transparency and accessibility that people basically can see. And you mentioned something about breaking down the invisible wall between the investment industry and retail investors.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I think we try, you know, on our website, on our correspondence, to speak in as plain English as we possibly can. So to make things simpler rather than more complicated, and to use a language that is accessible and that we feel that we can bring investors along with us in this journey of impact. So yes, that is absolutely the case. We are not, just at the moment, we're not open to retail investors yet. We're still only to professional and sophisticated investors as a limited partnership. Yeah. But then when we sort of IPO, the idea is that then it becomes a retail proposition.
Fantastic. I like that. I haven't seen it before in terms of, you know, breaking down the invisible wall, that expression. Like I said, I may even use that one for the title of this episode. And then, so if I then summarize in a way, so basically Snowball is a diversified multi-asset investment vehicle, you know, creating these outcomes, you know, for people and planet with the financial return. I picked up also that, you know, it's a funds of funds, multi-asset with public and private, right?
That's right.
And then you have, you know, the society that with this focus as well with the SDGs, you know, which not everyone, now everyone is catching up with it, but obviously you set it up from the get-go, you know, already focusing on these. And then I like the point you made, which is around that once you deploy the funds, that you're not targeting the highest of returns. I mean, you do quote on your website that you are seeking to 4% above inflation net of fees over the long term, but even over the 4 years of regular, and then you, over these tough times, you are saying that you are already performing very, very well. But I still talk to investors, and many are still, you know, chasing private equity type returns and double digit returns. And it's interesting to see a firm that actually, from everything that you talk about and through, is not about that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you have to be clear that those high returns come with high risk, right? A lot of the impact products, when they started, you know, the funds, impact funds, started in the private equity, venture capital side of things. And then a lot of people invested in them, and not all of them worked. In the same way that not all non-impact venture and private equity funds work as well. But then people got, oh my God, it didn't work because impact doesn't quite work. It's like, no, it didn't work because you didn't understand the size of risk you were taking. It was a venture type risk, of which several of those companies might never make it, but some might make it. And it's much harder, not impossible, as we've seen with some companies, but it's harder for you to be getting unicorns at every single company that is focusing on impact. It's definitely not impossible. We saw the Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, for example, in the vegan meats getting that kind of valuation. But the idea of making it a fund of funds is exactly that. It is a balanced fund. So yes, you know, we do have growth and venture inside our portfolio, and we do expect from them, you know, much higher return. But we also have yield products, and sort of now we have bonds and fixed income despite the sort of super low interest rates. You know, we have public equities. So the whole, and real assets, long-term real assets. We invested in sustainable forestry, for example. We invested in homeless homes, for example, housing for the homeless. And those are sort of long-term yield type assets that is not super high return, but they are much safer. They are sort of hedged by the asset itself. So the fund of funds idea was exactly that, so that it's easy for someone that wants to invest in an impact product, that they know that they won't have the sort of, they will have access to a global, because we're also global, not just UK. They have access to a diversified and global portfolio without the whole administrative and monitoring burden. We have liquid and illiquid assets, and we manage the liquidity for our investors. So it becomes a very easy proposition to invest and get access to all these funds. Curating the portfolio as well, assessing all these 300 funds, having an active, being an active investor, weed and rate every single impact and annual report from every single one of our funds. We participate in monthly calls with every single one of our fund managers. Mm-hmm. We look at the impact both, and then we can talk more about how we look at impact. We look at the impact both at the fund manager level and the enterprise sort of level.
Yeah.
And we offer this sort of deep impact working tirelessly with the fund managers with a competitive market returns aligned with the low risk that we're providing. So it's going to be a low risk. It's going to be a lower return, right? And the other advantage of a fund of funds is that it allows us to scale. So the fund of funds strategy allows us to really scale and scale fast as well.
Yes, yes. Let's also come back to some of that and kind of your investment approach and that kind of your approach to impact as well. But just before we move about kind of a snowball, I was wondering if you could share a bit of the backstory of how it was, how it came about, how it was set up, because I think it's truly inspirational as well. You know, you did mention that it's non-for-profit behind it.
Yeah.
There are some very key individuals as well that kind of masterminded it and dreamt about it before it happened, right?
That's right. So interestingly, the snowball was created by asset owners and they formed a group. So Alexander Hoare from the bank C. Hoare & Co. and Golden Bottle Trust and James Perry from Cook, Panapur and the B Lab gathered a group of others with Friends Provident Foundation, Skagen Conscience Capital, which is a single family office, Gower Street CIO, and the Taylor Family Foundation. So in total, these were six asset owners who came together because they couldn't find an investment vehicle that was intentional and diversified enough to create this broad systems change in financial markets in the way that they felt society and the planet required. And this idea of having a total impact solution in a fund that equally delivers compelling returns was the genesis of Snowball. So the interesting thing, I think, and the reason why I mentioned the governance, the reason why I mentioned everything is because they really thought it through so well that there is a huge internal consistency, you know, between the big ambition, our strategy, our structure, our governance. Everything is pulling in the same direction and consistent. So the beauty of that is that it then lends itself to a very neat being the embodiment of the change that we want to see. And so those people, I mean, Alexander Hoare and James Perry have been impact investors for a long time. Friends Provident Foundation, Colin Baines, as its mission to change this to change systems in financial markets. Louisa Mann from Skagen, Conscience Capital, they are a not-for-distribution family office, which means everything they invest in stays in reinvested in impact. So it never goes back to the principles.
Mm-hmm.
And Sophie and Nick Marple also formed a foundation called Gower Street together with the Taylor Family Foundation. So every single one of the founders and the asset owners are either their own endowment, like Panapur, who has, and James will not resent me saying this, they've put their entire endowment with Snowball. They've invested their entire endowment with Snowball. And we have foundations like that, and then this family office that is a not-for-distribution. So all of those asset owners have, you know, our non-profit shareholders, effectively.
That's fantastic.
And they fund us. I mean, to give them even more credit, because we charge, as you say, a low service sort of management fee with no performance fee. And the reason why we can do that is because those founders are subsidizing the general partner until we break even and the management fee can pay for our costs. Because what we didn't want to do is to put a high management fee or have to add, you know, a lot of other fees. We wanted to be very transparent and have a 1% flat, you know, fee to investors without any hidden other fees.
Yes, no, thank you for making that extra comment, because you'll hear me say this, you know, many times. I love, you know, perspective, because it kind of gives an idea to people of, you know, what it takes to build something like what you have. been building, and it also gives, you know, an idea to others, you know, to inspire them to understand how they can go about doing things. So thank you so much for sharing the list, sharing the steps, and also because it makes people realize that it takes time as well. So this is, you know, you have 4 years track record now, but this, I don't know exact date, but this must have started, you know, maybe 4 years before that in terms of, you know, the ideation of everything, right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, both James and Alexander, myself as well, even though I wasn't there from the beginning, I mean, we have been in the impact space for at least 15 years.
Mm.
So we have been in the impact space when it was a fringe, strange movement rather than something that is now, which is, you know, much more coming to the mainstream, which is fantastic. And, you know, the other part of Snowball, which I didn't mention, and it's also because we want to have this positive disruption, let's say, in the financial markets, we are very collaborative and we work with the entire ecosystem of impact to support the ecosystem. So, for example, we are often the first institutional investor in some new funds that are coming to the market, but, you know, they have to have a very solid and coherent proposition. But often we are the very first institutional investors in those funds, for example. We share our impact methodology publicly. We publish them. We publish two impact reports, one talking about how we measure the impact in the underlying companies, the other, the impact on fund managers. So there is a whole thing to your point about, you know, talking and inspiring others. We want many, many, many other snowballs to start and to be part of this market, because we need this if we really want to transform the way that we're running, you know, the economy, the world, to transform it to contributing to solutions.
Yes, here. And exactly, that's exactly why we're here, you know, to help, you know, always, you know, talk for myself and ILA and partners' mission of, you know, helping facilitate the transition into of capital into sustainable impact investing. And that's a thing what you are doing, which is great. And again, let me just quickly recap, you know, what I picked up in terms of, you know, this disruption, which is, you know, a word that has been used for by tech a lot of times, but maybe less for financial industries. And this, again, you know, I hear this point about the incentives, you know, the pricing, the costs, the financing as well as subsidizing of the costs, kind of the average kind of reduced returns because of the intentionality on the kind of on the other side. And the transparency, which goes hand in hand with this accessibility for others to come, which relates or links to the scalability of, you know, the approach. Because some people may say, well, it's a fans of fans, you know, you're not really disrupting anything, just to be a bit contentious, right? But it's the disruption sometimes is actually simple, but it's just about how you put the simple parts together and then deliver with the product, with the proposition and with the company like you are doing. That's what I'm taking away.
And I think to your point on the sort of low returns, we have run over the last 4 years, we have run a comparative regression analysis comparing our portfolio with the ARC, A-R-C, charities and private endowments portfolio, which is people that basically funds that have a similar strategy to ours without the impact addition, right? And our returns and volatility have been very much aligned with them. So these are pretty much market returns. And our volatility, to be fair, is a little lower than their volatility. But we probably will get up that curve a little bit because we didn't have, we had a little bit of cash drag in the beginning.
Okay, excellent. And that's a very interesting point as well I was going to make. So, you know, you have had the experience with venture philanthropy. We actually, on a very recent episode, the previous to this one, we had Peter Woolfley, which was the former CEO of UBS Group, who created his own foundation, the Lea Foundation, to do venture philanthropy, which, again, resonates a lot in terms of the evolution of some of these people that have had foundation, that have been doing philanthropy, the endowments, you know, of all the families that you mentioned, how I can see, you know, this evolution of the mindset and the approach and the actions that they are taking. And it's interesting now that you measure it to inverted commas other reality, which is the ARC benchmark, which is, you know, these people that are chasing just returns, they may not realize that in the end, you know, there is no much more of a difference aside from the negative impact that perhaps, or the unconscious negative impact that you are creating.
Yeah, because for us, and again, sort of from the beginning, this was very much in the genesis of Snowball. Unless we can offer competitive market returns, we are not going to be able to scale and to provide this level of disruption, because it's very nice to be a small little fund, you know, and say, yeah, we want to transform the market, you know. But unless we have actually size and scale, we are not going to, you know, we're not going to be able. And again, of course, we're not going to do this alone. There are lots of things happening, that there is a transformation happening anyway. But even, you know, in terms of our role in society and the markets and everything, you know, we need to have a sizable fund to be able to prove that this actually works, that you don't have to sacrifice returns to be able to deliver impact, you know, that this is something that everyone can do if they put their a lot of effort into it, but it's very feasible.
Yes. So maybe I go back now to that point that you made before. So 300 funds or investment analyzed, 29 in the portfolio, affecting 416 companies. So you have, I think, an AUM of 15 million right now?
That's right, 16, yeah. 16.
Mm-hmm. And you recently, you know, I think closed the fund that you just raised.
Yes, that's right.
You were, as we spoke, I think maybe towards the end of last year, you were basically closing the current kind of round of investments, right? And so with that, all of that in mind, I just wanted to like maybe touch upon, you know, your approach for investment, and maybe hand in hand with this approach for impact, because you started mentioning some of both, you know, in terms of, you know, you mentioned where you're focusing in terms of housing and communities, education, employment, I think financial inclusion that you didn't mention, social justice, environmental, you know, with the, some of the forestry perhaps. But I don't know if you want to like maybe share some more on this approach and to the investments and to the impact.
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of flavor for the portfolio, you're right, it's, as I said, you know, super diversified. So we have renewable, sustainable forestry, social housing, charity bonds, circular economy, tech for good, a whole variety in almost every single SDG. We just, the one SDG we had nothing on was aquaculture, and we just approved an investment in aquaculture. So it was SDG 14, life underwater, and we just approved that investment. But just to give you a bigger picture, a flavor of the portfolio. So for example, we have, in terms of asset class, we would have cash and deposits, but then we only hold those in ethical and community banks. We would have fixed income, and in terms of public and private, so in public debt, so bonds, the covenants that restrict proceeds to specific uses that deliver social or environmental impact. And we have, for example, a managed account with Rathbones that delivers that for us. And then we have the private debt, which we have a whole variety of supporting social organizations, both in developed and developing markets, including charities. We have co-ops, KICs, microfinance within private debt. Then if you go to real assets as an asset class, we have social housing, again, the sort of homelessness and supported living type funds. We have real estate, but these are social tenancies and green buildings. So interestingly, in the pandemic, because the rents and the yields from that come from government, they did really well during the pandemic as opposed to commercial property.
Yes.
And then again, in real assets, we have sustainable infrastructure, which is renewable energy, operating assets and development, you know, the sort of sustainable forestry and things like that. And then we have public equities, which is global in terms of global equities. And in public equities, we feel that, for example, that there is less additionality because a lot of it is trading the same shares and stock. It's very hard to prove additionality, but we choose public equity managers with a lot of care, and the high levels of ESG integration and engagement are expected of them, and they do that. They're very active owners and managers of global equities. And then finally, we have the private equity space, which is mostly venture and growth capital. And within that, we have social outcomes funds, things like social impact bonds or other types of investment for specific outcomes or specific underserved target populations. We have some early stage where we have social venture capital and accelerators. And we have sort of growth capital, which is funds that are scaling social enterprises in both developed and developing markets. And so that's kind of the whole portfolio. And as I said, I mean, you can hear super varied. I'm happy to give you some examples as well if you feel it's relevant. But that's the big picture.
Yeah, maybe let's talk an example when we talk about potentially the measurement part as well. So just before we do that, I was going to mention, it's very interesting that you go through all the different asset classes, all the different areas, because also when you listen to investors and you talk to investors and some of the products that we've been talking to, some of the organizations, you know, the larger organizations invest and looking for products in sustainable impact investing, you know, there's one question that I have seen across, which is around the specificity and the focusing on certain areas, which in your case, yeah, I would say that is one of the first that I look that is so diverse. I was just wondering, you know, how do you envisage that that conversation is going to go? Because it's fascinating to see how it was created and see the journey, see what you're doing. And yes, and I'm thinking like, are you going to be able to scale? Are you going to find, you know, investors that will like this broad range, you know, of assets?
Yeah, it's so interesting. We were asked this question several times, and this was a question in my head as well. Because, you know, for example, an investor might care for, oh, I like education or I like healthcare or, you know, that sort of thing. But it's interesting that our experience on the ground and the conversations that we've been having is that Snowball is attractive to sort of both first-time investors, which, you know, in a way they get to invest and learn from every asset class regarding their impact and also from every SDG. And then also from seasoned impact investors. So that's an interesting thing because, for example, one of our investors, he's been investing in impact for a long time, and he invests directly in education and ed tech. However, the conversation now is moving towards, and again, this is much higher risk. It's mostly either direct investments in venture companies and some funds as well. In this kind of education topic. But the rest of his portfolio is doing what? You know, in a way, it's hard to be an impact investor and not to think that all your assets should be producing some impact and positive impact, right? So the conversation with him is about, well, yes, your focus is in education, but part of his other portfolio, you know, because not every penny of his is investing in this way, right? Because otherwise it's a very, very high risk. The other part of his portfolio is invested in traditional capital markets, but a chunk of that is now coming to Snowball. Because what he's saying is actually, rather than just leaving it there and me having to manage all this variety of funds, I will invest in Snowball and know that it's a safer kind of impact, but actually producing, it's a safer sort of return, but it's producing deep impact. So it's an interesting thing. You know, you can have both. And he called this core and satellite strategy.
Okay.
So you have a core of your, you know, where your focus is, and then the satellite is where you park your other part of the portfolio, producing returns and impact for you, compounding year after year, as you then focus on carve out in where you want to have a specific focus on.
Okay. So this doesn't mean, so if I am an investor that I come to you, does my investment go into, you know, the fund and then the fund distributes, you know, as the strategy and the committee decide? So I won't be able to say, I just want you to do, it's not like a segregated account where I can just pick a certain part to go to a core education and then, you know, 70% and then 30% to the rest, right?
No, because exactly, if we did that, we will not be able to deliver the strategy that we say, in a way, the promise to the investor is a completely different one, right? Because if you choose, for example, let's say only our venture portfolio or venture in education portfolio, it's going to be a much potentially higher return, but higher risk as well and higher volatility, right? And no liquidity for a long time. So in a way, what we are saying here is that we have that mixture and that's the offering that we have for investors. However, that being said, larger investors do benefit from our research and due diligence if they want to double down and co-invest in the underlying fund. So for example, this aquaculture fund that we did a whole SDG 14 research, which is a big piece of research, and then pre-selected 10 different funds. We did a little bit more deeper analysis in 5 of them, and then we did the full due diligence in 1 that got approved by our committee, right? But this body of research and knowledge and interviews and everything that we've done there, there is one of our investors who is really interested in oceans and that particular SDG, and basically we're sharing that research and due diligence with him, and so he can then invest if he wants, obviously, and at his own risk, double down on the funds that we looked at and that we selected. Okay. That is an advantage from that perspective.
Okay, I get it. And then I wanted to ask you a very particular question on the operational side, but just before I move to that, liquidity-wise, how does it work if I come and invest in Snowball?
Yeah, so liquidity-wise, we are, you know, at the moment, because we don't have that much assets under management, as you said, you know, we have 16 million at this time. What we want is we're asking investors, rather than the traditional GPLP where you stay 10 years plus 2, you know, locked in, we're asking for a lock-in of 5 years, after which then we'll be able to provide some liquidity to investors, or 5 years ideally, if we don't float, 5 years ideally is the period that we think that we will be able to list and have an IPO, in which case then you have full liquidity, daily liquidity.
Yes. And maybe for the benefit, I'm sure that many people listening to the episode may know about this, but for those that haven't heard, you know, a lot of people talk about that, you know, if you don't have a fund, you know, above 100 million, basically that you, there's different expressions about this, but basically that you cannot pay the bills. And it's very hard to have a small fund. And obviously, you know, we do see on the VC side and other seed funding that, you know, there are smaller funds, but for what you're doing, and now it makes sense also the subsidies to be able to create all of these. But it's fascinating to see that with the size, which is, you know, inverted commas, small, but with the, you have managed to do it for so many years, with all of these research behind it, which brings me to the next question, which is like operationally, how are you managing? Because you don't have a huge team. So
that's right. And so incredible focus and in-depth research for global opportunities. So the way that we do it is we have a strategic asset allocation where we decide, you know, okay, so to combine this portfolio with a good balance, how much should we have? You know, what percentage of the portfolio should be in cash? What percentage in fixed income? What percentage in real assets? What percentage in public equities? What percentage in sort of private equity, right? Within that, we also look across, you know, the geographic diversity. We look across the SDGs. With all of that in mind, we then look at where the gaps are, either by asset class, by theme, or by geography. Geography, we have a concentration in the UK because we want to be able to, you know, before the pandemic, we wanted to be able to go to someone's office and look at them. Yeah. But we have a lot sort of UK and Europe. But we do have, you know, Africa, we do have US as well, one Pan-African and one in the US as well. And we want to diversify that more. So the way that we do that is that we then focus on asset class. So for example, because we now, as you said, we just sort of got regulated by the FCA and now the fund is open to sort of new investors, as opposed to the founders, you know, that started it for the first 3 years. We then anticipated that the minute that the money hits the fund, we are able to deploy it and invest it productively. So the first thing that we did before even we opened was a complete global research on public equities funds, right? So that now we have 5 public equities funds that we're able to deploy cash in the minute it hits our fund. Mm. So that is an example. Or, as I mentioned before, by a theme. So we had nothing on SDG 14, so we completed that research and did that. So it's being really targeted. And also, the thing that we have done is we looked forward into 100, and so we have 16 million now. We know and have a deployment plan for 150 million pounds. So we know the order in which we have to do this research and where broadly we want to deploy the capital as it comes into the fund. So that's how we can be a small team and have such a big breadth of investment.
Excellent. So laser focused, targeted,
and very planned.
Yeah, very planned, pipeline driven, you know, a lot of groundwork, you know, behind actually that goes on before you then get to shooting, right? But then when you can actually invest, like you say, you know, like shoot, you're ready for it. So very interesting. So that would be time maybe to talk about kind of how you identify and measure impact, and maybe talk about some examples, if that's okay.
Yes.
And you have a report as well. So I'm not sure if you want to mention the report, how it links with the SDG 14 report. I'm assuming some of them are very internal and some of them are, you know, very external.
Yeah, so you know, to simplify, of course, we have a lot of data behind this, but we measure impact at 3 levels. So the first one is what is happening on the ground with each investment. The second is how the fund manager works with the investments to improve their impact. And then how we as Noble work with our peers, the fund managers and investors to improve our approach and share our learning and support our fund managers with their impact. So that's what we published in the impact report. And the first level, you know, what's happening on the ground, we use the framework of the impact management project, which is the sort of 5 dimensions of impact. And they explain it super clearly in their website, which is, you know, the what is the impact, who is benefiting, what is the intensity or how much, you know, what is the contribution that we're making to that, and then the risk of impact not happening. On the manager impact, that's when we added a lot of thinking, because our main impact is how we work with the fund managers. This is our first primary folk, you know, sort of contact is the fund manager. And the fund manager framework in terms of measuring impact and thinking about it is also 5 dimensions. And we talk about philosophy and culture. So is this fund manager really has a mission to produce that impact? Is impact a little product that is on the side? You know, what is the whole organization thinking about this? Are they really committed? And then we look at process. You know, so, okay, so they say everything and they have a mission and that's very nice, but how do they make it work in practice? Do they have a process that secures that? Do they have systems that ensure that, you know, the impact is being tracked, is being measured? And then the third is, are they active owners? You know, we do not invest in passive managers. We want our managers to be active owners, because we don't think, especially when impact is complex in many respects on the ground, because each organization is doing something slightly different, you can't have a very passive strategy. So we want our fund managers to be active owners. And then catalytic, we look at that, you know, and catalytic means several things. It could mean, are they investing in a new service or product that is targeted at underserved communities, for example? Is this investment being really catalytic? Or the type of way, or the way in which they invest. So, oh, maybe this organization can only access short-term funding and they're now being, giving them long-term funding, and funding in a way that allows the underlying organization to continue and deliver that impact. And finally, how do they manage the risk that ultimately that impact doesn't happen for whatever reason? How do they look at that? How do they manage that risk? So these are the sort of categories that we do. And then we aggregate both the enterprise and fund manager score. So we score them, we score all of them under various categories that we have below each of those five dimensions. And we aggregate that into a bullseye report, which, the center of the bullseye is the biggest impact. And towards the outer layers of the bullseye is a much lesser impact. And that aggregation allows us to see the overall portfolio impact over time. So we can compare bullseye scores across time to see whether the investments we're making are moving closer to the center of the bullseye or further away from it. Then there is, I love the bullseye. I didn't invent it. I just love it. And the reason why I love it is because it allows you to ask all the right questions. So if you're an investor and you're looking at that bullseye, you basically say, oh, wow, you guys are so committed to impact. At the center of the bullseye, we have a five, right? And a lot of people say this. So are you a five in your aggregate bullseye or a 4.5? We're like, no, we're not. We're actually, a 3.7. And why is that? It's because some asset classes have limitations. Or, for example, sometimes when you invest in renewables, the impact is an impactful business, but it's mainly a result of the business model rather than a focus on improving impact, right? So that for us gets a 3 score. A 0 score is an aggregation that there is no consideration for impact. We have none of that. A 1 is where there is a focus on just avoiding harm and having some engagement. We don't have anything there either. A 2 is an impact that is mainly a result of the business model, but also not intentional and is not measured. We also don't have anything at a 2. So where is the concentration? Our whole portfolio is 3, 4, and 5. The 3 is, again, an impact that is a result of the business model, but they have a focus on trying to improve impact. The 4, or for example, let's say a 3 is a lot of the public equities portfolio, right? Because in public equities, we don't see additionality. A lot of time, you really don't have, depending on the fund manager, you don't have as much leverage on the business to be able to change behaviors on the underlying companies and some of these really big companies, right? Mm. So, but they have a focus on improving impact, and they are making an effort to increase that active ownership and influence. So that's a 3. The 4 is a lot, the majority of our portfolio is a 4 at the moment. And the 4 is when impact is intentional, it's measured, and it drives decision-making. So decision-making is based upon that impact that is really intentional. And the 5 is rarer because it implies that you already have a track record of a high-intensity targeted impact that leads to continuous improvement. So that is a really, really, and a lot of the, for example, social impact bonds or social outcomes contracts have that characteristic of being very, very intense in terms of impact. And it's targeted to a very specific population that is underserved and is leading to continuous improvement. So when you look at the score of the bullseye, it allows for those kinds of questions and allows for the right debate and talking about the difference between asset classes. It lets us talk about the intentionality and the difference in intensity with a simple little bullseye.
Thank you very much for the detailed explanation. That I think that's very, very valuable, and not often actually that we go into having these examples put that way. So thank you, much appreciated. And I will also recommend people to please, if I didn't say it before, visit noble.im, which is the website, and you will find there a couple of links to the report, to the impact management project, and also there is a really interesting document, which is the investor's perspective, building an impact management process for a multi-asset class portfolio, which, you know, if you are listening and you're interested to understand even more how it's possible to build something like a snowball, I think that could be helpful, right, Daniela?
Yes, absolutely. And we also did, we received a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation at the very beginning of Snowball as well. And one of their ideas was, because they thought we were such catalytic to financial markets, that they gave us a grant just to get going. And one of the conditions was for us to produce a report saying, you know, the step-by-step of creating Snowball. And we've produced that, and I think they will publish that as well. And as soon as that's published, we'll put that on our website. We have the idea of doing a webinar as well with Rockefeller, you know, to actually tell people the pitfalls, you know, the challenges, the things that we got right, the things that we didn't get so right in the beginning, and how we got to where we are. So that, you know, again, we do want others to, investors to really understand this market, but also others who want to create the market, to be able to kind of avoid the mistakes we've made and learn from the things that we've learned and step on our steps, you know, and yes, can go further.
Yes. That's exactly what we're doing here. So, you know, I'll be more than happy to join that event and also, you know, invite others. So do let me know once the report is there.
I will. Thank you.
And actually, let me put it out there. You know, we could record it and put it as a podcast episode as well, which I think would be extremely useful as a follow-up on this great conversation.
I will take you up on that. Let's do that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Rockefeller will be delighted with that as well.
Yes, I think that's brilliant. And you really surprised me with that one. I didn't know about that. So it's very nice, you know, and it's exactly what we need. And then maybe just not to go into too much detail, but if you give us like one or two examples, you know, because it's interesting to think about now the scales of the investments and the volumes, right? So what can you do with, and again, I always say this with care, but what can you do with 16 million, right? What can you do with 1 million? You know, if you think about it from an investor individual that has that money. So perhaps maybe one or two examples of, you know, some of the investments you have made. Now maybe with some names as well, just to give them some visibility.
Yeah, of course. So in the sort of, for example, in growth equity, private market, we've invested in Circularity Capital. This was the first ever circular economy fund. And we were, again, as I said, you know, we're quite catalytic in investing in sort of funds that have, you know, a high integrity, but also the fund managers were very experienced fund managers and very knowledgeable about the circular economy and created this fund, which is very focused in a really high growth market, actually. So thinking about the returns, you know, this is a very high growth market, solving a massive issue, which is waste. Right. Actually, the reason why I love this investment is because they made me completely rethink what is waste. We grow and live with waste, but actually the whole idea is we create the waste, right? Waste in this case does not exist. So the way that they think about it is to design and optimize products to re-enter the economy with their maximum value. So preserving, you know, the highest possible integrity of that product as it regenerates. So that's kind of the regeneration, which is different from recycling or disposal. Because recycling, you have a lot of embedded energy that gets lost, and materials are lost, the labor, all of that is lost when you kind of just recycle a product. But when you regenerate, you are actually extending the life and use of that product. So the circular economy has the aim of to design waste out and find better solutions. And that generates sort of premium investment returns, really. And within that fund, so again, this is a private sort of a growth capital fund. And one example of that, of a company within that, is Shark Solutions. So Shark Solutions is the market leader in producing a chemical, basically, that is high margin, sustainable, non-toxic, and recyclable, that they sell to a whole variety of industries. And that product is done by recycling the end of life of laminated glass. You know, for example, your windshield on your car, mm-hmm. right? That glass has a plastic, a thin film of plastic behind it. So if it breaks, it doesn't become a massive shard that kills you, but it breaks in little, you know, like your in little pieces, right? That are almost like square little pieces. But the problem with that is that when it there is an end of life to that glass, it is unrecyclable because you can't recycle the glass and you can't recycle the plastic because they are bound together. And this company found a way to separate those two products and able to reintegrate both. And it separates this plastic bit and it sells it to a range of industries and uses, paints, coatings, adhesives, flooring products. So it's that kind of thing that is sort of a regenerative and a circular economy. Yeah. So that's one example. Yeah.
Thank you. What was the name of that company again?
This is the company Shark Solutions. The fund is Circularity Capital.
Yeah, so circularitycapital.com for those that want to go and check it out. Very interesting and nice looking website. And then Shark Solutions is that example. Brilliant.
Yeah, we have tons of others in many different
categories. Nice. And then if people look at the report, will they see some of the examples as well in terms of, you know, your portfolio?
Yes, they will see. We have case studies with the fund managers. We have case studies in some of the investments directly. So yes, they will see not all of them, but they will see some examples for sure.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you.
And at the bottom, so if you look at the manager impact report, which is on the website, you can look at the funds that participated on that survey to arrive at the results. And so a lot of our funds, all the names are listed there at the end of the report as a thank you. So you can, and they all have websites. You can have a look at them and what they have underneath them.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Daniela. So now then, if we, you know, we talked about, you know, the past, the present, let's talk a little bit about the future in terms of, you know, obviously you have, you know, where you come from, you know, 2020 was a very particular year, you know, this year, which, you know, in many ways is special if you want to look at it that way. And then we have this, you know, dilemma and how we scale. I always talk about, you know, how do we scale sustainable impact investment? So any steps that you think, from one side, the financial services businesses, you know, should adopt to become more sustainable and impactful in one hand, and then on the other, how do we scale and how do we create potentially more snowballs and then grow snowball into hundreds of millions, if not billions?
I mean, our strategy is super scalable, so just invest in us and that's great.
Perfect.
But in terms of the, I think, you know, interestingly, impact investing has gone from sort of fringe movement to mainstream now. I mean, when I started in this you know, industry, in a way, we all knew each other and still kind of know each other a lot in the UK, but we all knew each other. It was like a, you know, a very, very few of us, and it was very, it was seen as almost a philanthropic effort, you know, and now I think people are seeing it as a proper investment in its own right. So I think that transformation has kind of happening, is happening. And the ESG or the sustainable part of it is now estimated at $40 trillion in terms of AUM. That was what I read on pensions and investments. And the GIN estimates the size of the global impact investing market to over 700 billion AUM. So still smaller, but I think, you know, that already is happening. So before, an investor had to look really hard to find impact deals. Now there is an abundance platform, investment clubs, funds, and people like you doing this amazing sort of, you know, a service of educating and divulging, you know, what is happening out there. We don't have yet a lot of retail alternatives or at all, which is, again, that's what we say we want to do. But I think that is the next stage. So what are the steps? I think the steps are standards and regulations. So this is improving, you know, making it easier for investors to both understand, compare, contrast different opportunities, and making it harder for sort of impact washing to occur. So this is, I think, is going to get harder and harder, and in a way for people to fake it. And I think easier and easier for investors to start to differentiate, you know, what is really producing impact, what is not. I think the same is happening with measurement and reporting. you know, when I started, everybody had their own proprietary black box methodology of impact that they didn't want to share with anybody because it was a top secret. And now I think it has completely changed. Industries coalescing around common measurement frameworks like the Impact Management Project, IFC, we've incorporated some of it as well. And that coalescing around, you know, common frameworks is allowing investors to be able to look and compare on strategies, on execution, rather than trying to decipher, you know, different sort of, you know, methodologies of impact. So I think that has improved a lot in terms of the ability of growth and scale there. Even sort of on the ESG side, you know, the big four are coming together to agree a framework of reporting. TCFD and SASB also coming together to harmonize, you know, their sort of frameworks and standards as well. So that also is happening on the sustainability side of things. And I think the next step, oh, you have the Harvard, of course, the impact weighted returns, sort of also very interesting approach, especially in public companies comparing across, which I think is leading to what I think is going to be a massive win, which is pricing of negative externalities so that the cost of capital reflects the true and total cost of doing business. And again, I think the challenge there is how do we do with poor countries and developing countries when you don't have, you might not have enough renewable energy to compensate for the dirty energy that they require. But, you know, I think that the pricing of the negative externalities is a fundamental step in terms of scaling and mainstreaming this. Because all of a sudden, if in addition to sort of say, you know, oversimplifying, you know, in addition to destroying the planet, you're also not giving good returns. I mean, forget it. Why would you ever invest in something like that, right? So I think that that is the next step. And I think I was reading, I think this week, that some banks are beginning to increase the price of debt for companies that are not sustainable in the long term. So they're signaling already that they need to change their model or their cost of capital is going to become more expensive.
Yes, definitely. If the risk is continuing to go up, right? So that's it. One for one or more. That's very interesting. And thank you very much for, you know, highlighting all the good things that are happening. I was just going to maybe replay a couple of points, you know, for people just to take to remind themselves or take away. It's interesting you mentioned the 40 trillion, right? So I remember the GSIA report on 2018 was saying that, you know, it's likely that 16% growth now, you know, we were going to hit about 40 trillion in 2020. But actually, I think that I saw the same report that you quoted before, which I think we hit we were over 40 trillion now, and that happened even before the end of 2020. And it's interesting to see again the point about the gene and the 700 billion, which is, you know, this we talked about at the beginning, the sustainable investment and then the impact, which, you know, gene looks a bit more at the more specific or, you know, a core impact investment. And then I was going to share, there's all sorts of different solutions, like you said, that are coming out. And I'll take advantage to mention one in the UK, for example, which, you know, there's different ways to do this, right? There's different apps that are trying to other people's products. There are some platforms. And then, you know, I interview Nigel Kershaw from the Big Issue Group, and then they launched the Big Exchange, which is interesting for the UK, quite interesting. You have, if you have an ISA, you can put your ISA into a selective bundle of sustainable funds, you know, with reporting and all sorts of other additionals. So there is different ways to do it from a passive and active perspective that keep growing, which is, you know, very interesting.
Yes, and the biggest, I love the sort of the concept of the big exchange is fantastic. And that is, you know, you're right. Actually, I completely forgot to mention that is sort of the beginnings of a retail proposition, which is phenomenal. We are very supportive. And actually, some of our investors, the investors in Snowball also invested in the big exchange. Nice. You know, our founding investors also helped found the big exchange as well.
And then, you know, and we have actually interviewed a few of the UK examples here. So we also have like the app, you know, to mention one, if people, you know, kind of some of the younger generation perhaps like it more. There is the Ticker, which is one. There's another one we have an interview, but I know.
Ticker is only public markets, yes.
Yes. But this is the nice thing about this episode with you, which, you know, because you have so many assets and we go through all the different layers, even if you are not a sophisticated investor and you listen to this episode for the first time, I am pretty certain that you're going to pick up a lot of different aspects of, you know, what an impact, how you can invest with impact. But yes, exactly like you said, and there's another one coming soon called Climate, which I found very interesting as well. Kind of again on the lower spectrum, let's call it, from that perspective. And then I mentioned some of the others, but it's interesting. And then one more thing as well, in around this time that we're going to publish, you know, this episode, we have the Article 8, Article 9, in terms of the classification of the sustainable funds, you know, kicking in Europe in March, which is another addition in terms of, you know, the greenwashing part, especially, and the reporting. And we're trying to get the guys from Harvard, the professor, you know, to come into the podcast as well, one maybe this year. So perhaps you can help us make that happen. And
happy to.
Yeah. And then the pricing point, that's fascinating, which is and the you know, the taking the cost into the cost of debt, you know, and obviously the WACC for investors, you know, which is, you know, is deemed to happen sooner rather than later. So, and then ultimately, and you know this, and you know, I talk about it, you know, as my vision and my dream, you know, our proposition to launch ILA Funds Investment Management, which is in a multi-asset strategy as well. I'm going to be humble here, but not as sophisticated as Noble. I think it's truly inspirational what you're doing. We're trying to, you know, keep it quite simple to start with, and, you know, again, with the view of scalability. But I'm sure that we can learn so much from you. And thank you for having everything in a kind of an open source environment as well, you know, which is very helpful.
Oh, of course, I'd be happy. I'm sure we'll have a lot to learn from you as well. We learn always from everybody that we talk to. So it's not never one way.
Indeed. And on that note, as we start coming to the end of the episode, I wanted to ask about you. You know, I know, you know, your story. I'm sure that we can have a whole other hour or days, you know, to talk about it. But I did wanted to share a little bit of the story, how you ended up doing this, which I think is fascinating. You know, you are now the CEO of Snowball, but you're still also a non-executive director at Halma, chair at Gove Digital. I think there's another one. There's a few more that are not actually named anywhere. I think we talked about Evora maybe when we last time.
Yeah, I left Evora this year.
Okay.
So, yeah,
okay.
No.
But yeah, you are an executive and a non-executive. You sit on board. And how did you end up? How did you end up doing all of this?
Yeah, I mean, so making a long story short, I mean, as you know, I grew up in Brazil, grew up seeing a lot of inequality and poverty. You can isolate yourself and in a bubble and pretend it's not there, but I wanted to do something about it. So I started volunteering when I was 12 years old, which allowed me to sort of, you know, go to orphanages and asylums and slums. And I always wanted to do something about that. And the big drive for me was to, you know, get people out of poverty, really. Mm-hmm. But I knew through this experience that I couldn't be a social worker. I have so much respect and awe of social workers, but it wasn't my calling or where my strengths lie. So I thought of several things, you know, other than being a social worker, I didn't know what else I could do, you know, to contribute. So I thought, well, maybe if I go into politics, but that was a very quick foray into politics to feel very disappointed with the whole thing. It was much more about trying to score points than actually solve the problems, at least my experience was. And then I got into finance a little bit out of doing economics, university. And then I thought, well, you know, if at least I understand how to make money, I can give it all away and I can do something different. It was a very, very kind of binary world and thinking that I no longer share necessarily. But also that didn't happen anyway, because before I made a lot of money, which I didn't, I found a way to marry my skills to creating positive impact. So I started working in finance. I moved mostly in private equity and venture capital investing. And from that, I've always volunteered. So I was always volunteering on the front line. And when I was living in New York, I volunteered to help the CEO of a charity to do her business plan and strategy. And for me, working in private equity venture capital, I was looking at business plans every day of the week, right? And it was such an easy thing and for me to do. And for the CEO, this was like, you know, a revelation. And that for me was the first time that I realized I could use my skills into a different setup. So I did quite a radical move from private equity to Save the Children, where I stayed for a couple of years. And I was then recruited to lead Impetus, which at the beginning was a startup, very, very early days. It was a venture philanthropy organization. And I then stayed there for 9 years, taking it from the startup to scale and developing the strategy, the structure. We did a merger. We used the best of venture capital models to allow, you know, the sort of social enterprises and charities to scale successful models that had impact. So, and that was 15 years ago, and my first foray into impact investing. And actually 16 years, almost 17 years ago, I say 15, but actually almost 17 years ago. And that was my first foray into impact investing. I've always been very curious. I have an MBA, so my brain is sort of business as well. I like to understand how business works. I like to understand how things work, business models, and whether they are for-profit, non-profit, government. And because of that sort of curiosity and desire to learn, I ended up getting to all sorts of things. So I've worked with government. I've sat on government boards. I sit on the board of a FTSE 100 company, as you mentioned, Halma. I just became a trustee of a think tank that is focusing on technology and the world of work. So how, as technology evolves, how do we make sure that we don't leave people behind, right? And the pandemic brought this to such a highlight, right? We are all now working with a lot of technology. The companies are digitizing more and more. But guess what? You know, all the jobs that supported the cities and supported the entire world are jobs that are not done remotely. These are jobs of some of the lowest paid in society. These are our nurses, our carers, our tellers, our bus drivers, our bin collectors. So how do we not leave people behind as technology starts to grow into our society? So that's the new thing. So basically, yeah, so I have this very eclectic experience and I love it. I love to be able to do different things. I actually just left the chairing of Govit Digital because for a fantastic reason that we got the first round of institutional investment in and they're doing really well. And of course, having a chair in London when you are actually in Brazil doing your work for institutional investors, that doesn't go. So I knew that. And I had put my chairmanship on the line from day one on that account. And I helped bring that investment as well. So yeah, that's kind of me.
Again, you know, I happen to have had the benefit of listening to some of the details behind and the minute of things that took you into one another direction. But the one thing I did remember, if you don't mind me sharing, was I remember that point where you took that role on Save the Children. And there are some kind of pivotal points that at least I picked up when you were telling me, you know, kind of the longer version. And the one thing that I wanted to share with people is that it's interesting, again, how you see companies or, you know, how you perceive individuals. And I was telling you before that, you know, for me, perhaps, and for many, you know, if they just look at Snowball and Daniela, you know, they may see that, they may imagine that it's your fan, that it's your company, or that everything was, you know, straightforward from Brazil to Harvard to being the CEO of this disrupting investment management firm, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that easy, right? It was far from easy.
It never is, right? Yeah. It never is. It takes a lot of effort and determination and tenacity. So it never is. I mean, I remember once actually was a friend of my brother's. He said, "Wow, you're so lucky. I'm amazed at how lucky you are." I said, "I'm not lucky. You know, I've done a lot of work to get where I am, you know, so it's not, yes, there are some things that are, you know, there are luck in life. And of course, you know, I had opportunities, which a lot of people don't have. So there is that as well, right? So I'm not pretending that, you know, someone that was born in a slum has the same opportunity set yes. that I had. Yes. So that, you know, definitely I recognize that and I feel very privileged to have had that. But beyond that, you know, is what you do with the opportunities you're given and how you try to make the best of it. And also marrying with your values. You know, I always had this thing so strong with me from very early age and this sort of always trying to reconcile, you know, what am I doing on the day to day? What gets me up, you know, in the morning with actually what I want to see in the world, you know? So I think that's the kind of thing that sort of moved me. And when I went to see the children, it was a little bit like that. So my career wasn't planned. I didn't have plans, right? I had a very clear path of career development when I was in venture capital. And then this opportunity to save the children happened. And I just jumped. And at that point, I thought, oh my God, you know, it's all for the impact because I have no idea what kind of career looks like in this environment. And this was in the beginning of the year 2000, right? And of that decade, it wasn't very common for people with my background to go into the nonprofit sector. And I had no idea where it was going to lead to. And I felt so dumb because when I got there, I was like, oh my God, my salary is not enough to pay for my rent. You know, like all of a sudden, I was like, "My, what have I just done?" You know, I was so hungry to go and marry my impact. So this is a piece of advice I don't give people. Don't do that. As a finance person, don't make the mistake of not calculating very well what your salary is going to be when you make a brutal career change like that. You know, it was that kind of stuff. I was really hungry for it.
And I do remember you mentioning, so you were actually, I think it was Harvard, Bank Boston, US, then you got the opportunity to come to the UK, then you took on that role, and then you took me through the different things that you had done. And I remember sharing with you when we talked about it, maybe to use that word, you know, so the attitude first, you know, I just picked up on your attitude yeah. to say yes. And to try something, right? And to do it. And these days I was reading a book and you know about Roman times when there was this role of people to clear the way and to help bring attention and help other people, right? Which then in that way they used to get paid. And it just really reminded me about people like yourself that actually take on jobs to help other people, perhaps not even getting paid, but just you know, for the fact of getting the experience, trying to help, which then, again, if I could pick up on some of the stories you told me, it's amazing to see then how that generates the opportunities, right? 15 years after, because, you know, a lot of people, and then also, I must admit that two other things I picked up from you, aside from this, funny enough, impetus, you know, this force of nature that you seem to have, is that you have been kind of explicit and told everyone what you were trying to do, and you were kind of effectively very clear about the ask. And then there was some serendipity. I remember you telling me the story about in the lift when you went to visit some of the guys, and then one person told you about the role that they were hiring for. But it's impossible to see all of that, you know, in the future. And then when it happens, you don't even realize that it's happening, right?
Yes, and I think you're right. I mean, there are two points there. One is I do like a challenge. So when I was at Harvard, for example, in the MBA, I said, oh, you know, I actually would like to work with private equity. And at the time, this is 96, right, 97, and private equity industry was very small compared to what it is today. And I remember talking to a colleague of mine who was one of the few people in my class that had been to private equity. And he said to me, "Danny, can I be honest with you? Brazilian trying to work in private equity, it's a white men's club in the US, so I don't think you're going to get it. And I was like, oh, challenge, accept it. So I do like a challenge. You know, when I got the board of Halma, I was told the same way, well, you work for a nonprofit. You want to be on the board of a FTSE company? I don't think so. You know, I was like, okay, let's see. So it's, I think in a way, and you're right, so that I do like a challenge, and when the risk is measured, because the risk was just me, you know, and those, I didn't have children to support and things like that at the time, you know, so it's fine. You know, I took that kind of risk. But also, I am very clear about where I want to get to, so that actually I get help from people and I ask for help. Yeah. So a lot of people do not ask for help. I don't know if they're proud. I don't know what, you know, what is, but I do ask for help. And I say, look, I want to get here and you have been there. So can you tell me how to do it? And a lot of the times people not only tell you, but they help you to get there. And in the same way that I try to help other people that come after me and want to do the same things that I have done. So I think, you know, with all of that, that has been a sort of two things, a hallmark in my career. You know, one is liking a challenge, yeah, and having the courage to pursue it. And the other one is when I'm clear about where I want to go next, telling people about it and asking for help.
Perfect. Thank you. And then you mentioned, as we just about to finish, the last two, but on this subject that, you know, the industries and being, you know, back then, kind of an industry of men, and we actually have over 50% of the listeners, you know, are women, interesting enough, although, you know, we do find the challenges sometimes to get women to accept the invitation to join us, as you have, and thank you again for that. But any specific recommendation, you know, to maybe combine, you know, to get your first board seat or to get those roles, and again, you know, especially or particularly perhaps, you know, as a woman?
I think, first of all, I mean, it's great that I have over 50% of women listening to those podcasts. And it does, there are some research that suggests that women are very, very interested or even more interested than men on the whole impact investing, yes, side of things, which is fantastic. And it doesn't surprise me, therefore, that you have this audience. I think, you know, it depends where people are at in their careers in terms of, for example, getting on the board of a company. So it's hard to give a generalized advice in that sense. But if, you know, I would say that if that is your, if you have that desire or that ambition, I mean, you need to, how do you get the leadership experience? Because what the boards are different from the sort of having an executive role. You're there to sort of advise, and you have a big governance job as well on the company. So you're there both to supervise, monitor, advise, and sign off on budget, sign off on strategy, sign off on a lot of big responsibilities. So the more you have the ability to put yourself in leadership positions where you have those kinds of responsibilities, whether as an executive or as being on different types of boards, the better it is for you to then sort of proceed to that, to kind of getting into a board, for example, of a public company or a larger company as well. And it depends a lot on your own experience and expertise. So if you're very, very focused on a particular area in your executive life and in your experience, well, then it will be easier to, of course, go where this kind of knowledge and expertise is sought after. So it really, really is hard to give general advice, but, you know, I'll share my process. So I was the opposite of what you generally see in a board member. I'm a Latina. I was very young when I joined the board from a sort of a traditional board member. I was working in a nonprofit. So really, I was the opposite of what you would expect to see as a non-executive director in a UK FTSE listed company. But again, but at the time I was already a CEO and I had experience of some other boards. I then asked different people for help. So I first of all got my board to authorize me to take a board position. I asked, you know, some of my trustees for help and their thoughts as to how I should go about it. I talked to headhunters who basically told me, oh, your CV is not a board CV. You need to create a different CV for a board position. So I changed my CV. I looked and did a lot of research as to what would be attractive, that I, what can I offer to a board and what does it look like, right? And so to translate that, and then I really went after my networks and basically said, look, I want to get on a board. This is what I am aiming for. Is there anything that you know? Is there anyone that you would introduce me to? And that sort of thing. And including a very senior woman who was one of the very few women that was chairing a FTSE 100 board. And she's brilliant. And I have a massive amount of respect for her. And I had met her, but we weren't close. She wasn't a close friend or acquaintance of mine. But I thought, well, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. The worst that can happen is she doesn't reply to my message. And I sent her a note saying, you know, this is what I wanted to do and all of that. And she was so helpful to me, including introducing me to a board. It wasn't a public company, it was a private company. But that introduction and subsequent interview got me a position on that board, which I then didn't take because I got offered this public board. But just to know, you know, this is something that a lot of people would say, oh no, this person would never have time for me, or this person, you know, and it might have been serendipitous, but it happened, right? And if I hadn't tried, you know, I wouldn't have had that experience. So I think it was that kind of planning the steps and executing and really not see, it's not that you don't see the obstacles in front of you. It's not that you don't see that you are a rare species in a different environment, right? But you don't let that block you. I think that's the thing. You know, yeah, see it, but don't pay too much attention to it. You know, just carry on anyway. And give yourself realistic targets. So I put myself 2 years to get to a board position. So it's kind of like, well, in 2 years, I'll get something. You know, that was my kind of estimate. So I think that's the kind of thing that I would recommend in general. At least that's the experience I had. Yeah. For whatever it's worth for other people.
No, I think that's exactly, you know, I thought that would have been useful to hear, you know, very insightful and methodical. So I'm sure that not only women, but men listening will find that extremely useful. And it's interesting you mentioned, I can relate to the point about even sometimes myself, I do it, you know, I think I have come across Snowball, you know, somebody kind of mentioned the company, mentioned you, perhaps, I'm trying to remember now, even if maybe if I look at the profile, you know, you can start imagining things. You say, oh, that person, so I think what most people think is that the persons are, people are too busy, so they won't have time. So why am I even going to bother to reach out, right? And I had you particularly, and that's a real example in my list of people to connect, you know, and have in the podcast. And then it was thanks to Will Campion who kind of ignited again, you know, the conversation. And then thanks to that, we ended up, you know, meeting. And since we have met, met remotely, it has been fantastic and fascinating. You know, and I have a new best friend. So
yeah, I feel that. It was a great, we had a 30-minute conversation booked, which ended up being 2 hours.
Again,
as far as I can remember.
Again. So on that note, let me ask you the one before the last question. And you know, since you actually have you know, mentioned the concept leader, right? So being a leader, mm-hmm. What makes an impact leader to you, Daniela?
I think someone that recognizes that they're never the finished article, always learning, improving, growing, having humility, understanding that things are changing and things change. I think in terms of the size of the issues that we have to deal with right now, I think you need someone who thinks systemically, you know, and it's very easy to get trapped into your little world, you know, your little world of work, of what you're doing, of what, you know, your own little place, your own little thing. And I think that ability to think beyond and to think collectively as well, to think about the other. And how does the system affect me, but also how does the system affect the other, you know, and the various others? Is it working for all the various stakeholders, you know? So I think that kind of more systemic thinking is a characteristic of an impact leader and a leader that wants to have that level of impact and wants to kind of work in this area. So, and then when you look at that system, then it's to say, where is my place in this system, right? With what I have to offer, which is all unique. I know this sounds cliche, but it is, right? With my unique set of skills and also who I am as a whole, you know, not just the bits I can do, but actually the person I am as a whole, right? How can I contribute? What can I do to mitigate, to influence the system for more equality, fairness, justice, you know, and to create a better world, right? And so I think that's the kind of thinking, I guess, mindset of an impact leader. And with that mindset, then whatever you do will be then, you know, kind of right for you. You know, I didn't think I would be working. It's interesting because before joining Snowball, my thought was, I'm not sure I want to work in finance anymore, right? And I was thinking more, I want something that is genuinely creating a big impact and creating an impact and that can be scaled and can work for a lot of people, right? So that was my thinking. And I was very open about which area, which sector, which, you know, what it was going to do. For a while, I did a project into aquaculture and, you know, sort of sustainable ways of securing aquaculture so that the fish population is not depleted, that the nutrition of the fish is not, you know, lots of different things like that, which was really interesting. But then when Snowball came up, I thought, actually, you know, this is exactly what I said I wanted to do. And even though it was in finance and I didn't think I was going to go back to finance, that is what worked and is working so far for me. So, yeah.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for that. And it's interesting as well about, you mentioned the place, knowing your place, but now the remote way of working as well changes the actual meaning of place, not only in terms of an individual, but as a person. And it shows that you can do so much more. Although a lot of people were doing it before, you can still... It's more evident now that you can do it from anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for everything, Daniela. The last one is basically your final call to action for the listeners, aside from, you know, investing in Snowball.
Thank you. Well, it's been a great pleasure. And thank you so much for allowing me to participate here and have this chat with you. I think, look, the biggest call to action is, you know, we're 10 years to 2030, the clock is ticking, you know, the emergency is not a small thing. And I think we need to change, you know, the way that we look at things and we see things and the way that we live our lives. You know, what are we doing in practice? You know, and none of us is perfect, right? So let's also not be so pedantic that, you know, we all have inconsistencies. But my big call to action is there is a gap of $4 trillion a year if business and capital do not get a move on in terms of achieving the sustainable development goals. So impact investing will play a very important role in advancing the progress towards this goal. So I think, you know, as we think about our role in a broader set, not just as I was talking before in terms of career, but, you know, our role, what is it that I'm doing in my day-to-day life with my, not just with my money, but with my time, with my resource, with my efforts, the things that I consume, the things that I buy, the way that I treat them, the way that I look into them, all of it. I think this is the big call to action. We need to rethink everything. And I think that is the demand side of things, right? There is a demand for us to think like that and to act differently. The supply side of it is that really there is a growing desire for impact options. You know, investors want impact. You know, consumers want products that are better for the environment and for society, right? So there is also that side of things. So I think if we accelerate that, it's going to be a very prosperous, you know, 10 years for us to kind of reach this goal as a human race.
Amen. Amen. Fantastic. And how can people get in touch with you, Daniela?
Well, the website, which is snowball.im, yes, or the email, which is hello@snowball.im.
Perfect. Well, I can only echo everything you just said in terms of the call to action, and I really appreciate everything that you're doing and that unique energy. So thank you so much, Daniela. Yeah, and maybe the next episode, you know, when we go through your report. So it is bye for now, and until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA and partners. Please connect with us to work together in the transition of capital into sustainable and impact investing. If you would like to support the podcast more specifically, we will be soon launching the Supercast and Patreon subscriptions. Or email podcast@ilaandpartners.com to become a sponsor or patron.